I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. There are clams invading Lake Tahoe. This is bad news. Why it's so damaging and how the clams got there on the show today. Where to eat in Ventura and Santa Barbara. It's nearly St. Patrick's Day, time to drink some beer and drink some more beer. So why are pubs disappearing in Ireland? I'll tell you. Pig trotters, they're coming back, plus what we really don't know about the food we eat. But first, let's see what we can cook from the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're able to catch up with a good longtime friend of ours here at the market, Mark Peel, who's running around every Wednesday with his walkie-talkie and his clipboard and checking out the produce. And he's got his foragers out working you. Yeah, Mark. And so, as usual, we love what you do. And tell us what you're cooking. Give us a quick recipe.
Oh, yeah. Okay, it's early spring. What's coming out right now are all those early spring things like green garlic and the spring onions. Just beautiful. I like to make a little green garlic soup, or you can make it just like the leek and potato soup, where you stew the green garlic, wash it, chop it up rough, simmer it with some russet potatoes, some water, a little bit of butter until it's all tender, puree it. And then also, the fava beans are coming out just the beginning of the season. They're absolutely beautiful, about the size of your fingernail of your pinky. They're kind of expensive right now because they're so small and a lot of work, but absolutely worth it.
Now, Mark, at that stage, the fava beans, when they're that little, can't you cook the whole bean, or do you still have to take them out and peel them and skin them and all that?
Fava beans are a lot of work because you got the big outer pod that looks like a giant green bean. You have to take that off. When they're really small and tender, you don't have to peel them again.
Okay, so when the bean itself is less than, say, 4 inches long,
right,
you do have to take that outer husk off because it's really thick.
Well, I think it's not how long it is, it's how thick it is.
Okay.
That's important.
All right.
Right? So it's just...
You say so.
I should know. You know. Anyhow, so they're really young and tender, and they're great actually with the soup that I just described. You just take those, quickly blanch them, scatter them over the top of the soup. And with the soup, I think, did I mention you need to strain it? Because there's a lot of fiber in the green garlic, and you just have to strain it through a sieve.
And how do we? Okay, and then how do we differentiate the green garlic from the green onions? They all just basically look like scallions. So how do we tell them all apart?
I can tell that you can do it by aroma. You pick it up and you stick it under your nose. If it smells like garlic, it's garlic. But it does look a lot like baby leeks. Yes.
Yeah, they all.
When in doubt, ask.
Okay, or sniff.
Okay. Garlic is no secret.
Okay.
You just think potatoes,
green garlic,
spring onions, water, a little bit of butter, touch of chicken stock if you want to, simmer, tender, puree, strain.
Okay.
The end. Salt, pepper.
Equal parts of onions, garlic.
Yes.
And then how much water, say for a bunch of each, how much water?
To make a decent soup, I would say you need at least 4 bunches of green garlic and 4 bunches of spring onions.
And then how many potatoes?
I would say a pound and 2 quarts of water.
Okay.
Or a quart of water and a quart of chicken stock.
Sounds fabulous. Now, are you going to serve this at the restaurant too, or is this at the home?
Definitely at the restaurant, but maybe not tonight.
Too much
work.
I've got
to go find my fava beans.
That was Mark Peel, and he, of course, is a chef owner at Campanile. He's here every week. He's got his trusty sidekick, Jack, and they have walkie-talkies, and they forage, and they find great produce all around the market. And we'd love to catch up with Mark and get a nice, simple recipe we can make at home. We haven't had a chance to visit lately with Bill and Romeo Coleman, who, of course, are the family that run the Coleman Farm. The Coleman Farm always has amazing produce to check out. And today, Bill, I wanted to catch up with you. First of all, I want to say I've never seen a radicchio that looks like this. Can you kind of describe what it looks like and explain what the variety is?
The variety is Grumolo radicchio. And you cut the main head off in the fall, and then in the springtime, these little shoots come out. Small
it's almost
heads.
Like a little aster. It's just like little flat, long leaves, almost fanned out like a flower.
It's like a little flower, and you can use it in salads. You can use it braised. It's very good for braising, or put it in soup.
And it tastes the same as the normal kind of a bitter, right. Pungent green.
Yeah. It's a little less bitter because it comes out in the spring when there's a lot of water.
Tell us something else you got that you want to talk about. I just don't know where to begin with you.
Celery root.
Yeah.
Celery root is it's a variety of celery that's grown for the root, but however, the tops are very, very good in stock. And the root is very good in soup.
Now, they're really hard to clean. I noticed you've cleaned it. It's very, very, it's like a big lumpy knot, and it's full of little crannies that are full of dirt,
right,
and roots and stuff.
Right, and that's where the big roots come out. You just cut that off.
Okay, so to get it home and clean it, you really do have to kind of chop it all up and really give it a good rinse.
Like you would a potato or anything else.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I've never used the tops because they were so strongly flavored.
Well, that's why a little bit, and it goes a long ways.
And then one more thing. Let's talk about,
pea shoots. These are the shoots of a pea, a special kind of pea that we raise for the shoots because they're more tender and sweeter. And you can eat the shoots, the flowers, the leaves, the tendrils, everything but the main stem, which can be kind of tough. They're very good in salad.
You can also sauté them.
Sauté them very quickly, like spinach. If you're cooking them with shrimp, sauté the shrimp first and put them at the very last.
Very inspiring to be here and see all this beautiful stuff. That was Bill Coleman, and his family is here at the Wednesday Market in Santa Monica. They also do the Santa Barbara markets. We're visiting also this morning with David Karp, who we love to catch up with and get him to tell us what's absolutely extraordinary. Today he pointed out an amazing pomelo. That's that oversized grapefruit that is very popular for the Chinese New Year. There is a family here, Mud Creek Ranch, and they have a variety called a Tahitian pomplamoose, and it's a lemon-lime flavored pomelo that literally tastes like you're eating a can of Sprite. It is a sweet, citrusy, juicy fruit that I was absolutely amazed by. So check out Mud Creek Ranch if you're at a market and you find them, and ask for their Tahitian pomplamoose. You will love it. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Actually see what Laura Avery just talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can check out the Good Food blog there, too. It's full of all kinds of finds and stories, including guest bloggers. Lots of stuff you won't hear on the actual show. Check it out online at kcrw.com/goodfood. Also, if you're interested in attending a benefit for the Farmer's Kitchen, which is a project that the folks at the Hollywood Farmer's Market have been working on for a couple of years, go to our website and take a look at the event that's coming up this Monday night. St. Patrick's Day. It all started in Ireland and somehow got transformed into green beer here in the U.S. I'll be back on Good Food to see what's up with pub culture in Ireland and the country that drinks the most Guinness in the world. No, it's not Ireland. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. How soon after you say or think the word Irish does the word pub jump into your mind? Pretty quick, I'd guess. What is the pub really? How did the gathering place evolve? And what's the current state of the Irish pub in Dublin? Bill Barish writes for The New Yorker. His new book, A Pint of Plain, chronicles his search for his own local pub. Tell me a little bit about what your search was all about. You married a Dubliner, I understand.
That's correct. That's what brought me. I met her in London and moved to Dublin about 8 years ago. And one of the first things on my agenda, of course, was to find a local pub. I thought this is the way that I would meet people. And I had in mind, well, I was steeped in all the romance of Ireland, and I had seen The Quiet Man far too many times. And imagine a sort of very quiet place, you know, with men in flat caps sitting in corners and conversing in that wonderful Irish way. And there were 8 pubs within the mile, or not even a mile, half mile from our house. And I thought it would simply be a matter of choosing the one that I liked best, that most fit that kind of ideal. And I was soon disabused of that idea, because the pubs in general are tending to try to be American.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, the look of the pub has changed. The first thing I discovered is that even in Ireland, you can walk into a pub that appears to have been built in 1918. But in fact, many of the things in such pubs are props, that they're bought from suppliers, decorators. You know, the country was isolated and quite poor for a very long time. But 10 years ago, when the economy boomed, there was a real desire to sort of join the global community and a great desire for things American. So many pubs now would look a bit like an American sports bar. Or like the Irish pubs that you find, say, in New York, in that they'll have a number of TVs that are on all the time. They will have a soundtrack playing all the time. The idea of the pub as a quiet, contemplative space is certainly under threat.
Let's talk about sort of the pub as the gestalt. What role did it have? And I'm curious to know what the offerings are. Like, what is the food like? How many kinds of beers are available?
The pub traditionally was a community center, you know, and there was a time, you know, there's a history of the pub that needs not be, that you don't have to bemoan. You know, there was a time when it was strictly the province of men, and particularly men who would spend pretty much anything they had at the pub. And it also used to be the only source of entertainment. I mean, there were a few theaters, movie theaters in Dublin, really very little to do. But by 1960 or so, that all began to change, and pubs were a bit gentrified. But in the country in particular, they were often a place that sold groceries as well, certainly a place where you could you would exchange gossip. Everybody would know what was going on in the community. In some cases, they would have a post office attached. And in the countryside, it's really the worst of the scene. The pubs are dying out at the rate of one a day, and that's due in part to a rapid suburbanization. So in a sense, the death of those pubs signals the death of the Irish village as such, and that's a very sad development. And it also spells bad news for the Greenbelt. You know, much of rural Ireland is quite beautiful. But now more and more sort of ticky-tacky suburban developments have gone up, and the people will be commuters rather than villagers.
Let's talk about the role of Guinness in the pub. That was sort of your benchmark when you started this pub crawl, to find a place that you really loved and where you would feel comfortable. How do you go about ordering?
Well, you ask for a pint. Actually, younger people, Guinness is in trouble in Ireland. The bulk of their market now is global. There's more Guinness sold in Nigeria than in Ireland. Younger people tend to look upon it as an old person's drink, and they're much more likely to order, I'm sorry to say, Coors Light. Yes, I know, it's a shocking thing. And to further shock you, they will often pour it over ice and drink it with ice cubes. But things like Bud and so forth are very popular. They're manufactured under license by Guinness and other firms. I mean, Guinness has for years been trying to figure how to reach out, and they've introduced things like a Guinness Light that died a very quick death.
That's an oxymoron if I've ever heard one.
It is, yeah. Well, I mean, Guinness is not a very strong beer, which is something else that people don't. I mean, they think of it because it's so heavy, you know, on the stomach. They call it a meal in a glass, you know.
Didn't Guinness sort of cause this transformation of the pubs into something more internationalized?
Well, yeah. No, Guinness is, you know, has for a good 20 years at least promoted the idea of the Irish pub abroad. And they have a website that you can visit. In essence, what they are, they're a sort of broker, and they developed this scheme in order to find more outlets beyond Ireland for their product. So if you go to that website and you're somebody who wants to invest in an Irish pub, they will set you up with somebody who's going to design it for you and build it for you. And it's quite amazing. The biggest company in Dublin is one called the Irish Pub Company. And they've built, for instance, over 100 pubs in Italy.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you.
Bill Barish has written for The New Yorker and other publications for many years. He's the author of 7 books, including his most recent, A Pint of Plain. Go online, tell me where your favorite pub is or what your favorite beer is. I truly love beer, which you must know from listening to this show, and I'd love to hear about your favorites. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and comment. You can email me, too. The address is goodfood@kcrw.com. I can't believe how many vegetarians and vegans I run into on a daily basis. It's overwhelming how many people are foregoing meat and animal products. So it's with curious celebration that a restaurant called Animal has not only opened in L.A., but it's become really popular. I'll be right back with the owners. They'll tell you all you need to know about pig trotters. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Of all the newish restaurants to open in L.A., something Animal has crept under people's skin. That's, of course, the place owned by John Shook and Vinny DiTolo, which just may be the apotheosis of dude food writ delicious. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks for having us in.
Appreciate it.
Okay, so the first question I have to ask is this. Animal is located in the largely Jewish and pretty much Orthodox community of L.A. called Fairfax. How have they reacted to your pork-filled menu?
Well, I think the way people look at L.A. and they look at Fairfax, it used to be very Orthodox, and there used to be a very large Jewish community. I mean, there's skateboard shops, shoe shops, T-shirt shops all up and down our road now.
It's become very diverse, I think, in the stores and the people surrounding.
Why don't you guys describe your food for us?
I think the food that we do there is definitely American regional. We tie some other flavors from other countries into it and deeply based on French technique, I think. And I think that it's just the spirit of us and who we are and, you know, our interpretations of things we love to eat and things we love to cook. And I think the menu reflects that. I think it's something that is diverse with ingredients that chefs love to eat and chefs love to cook. And people don't always find such a heavy amount of those types of ingredients on the menu in one place.
So we have to talk about bacon.
Yes, we do.
Because bacon is such a muse for the two of you.
I know everybody always calls out bacon. For us, I think it's the actual pig itself that we're so infatuated with. I mean, it's the other white meat. It's awesome. There's so many different variations and techniques that you could do from it.
But what made you decide to put it in a chocolate dessert?
That kind of came from an inspiration to do this actually catering event that we had with cafeteria food.
And, oh, how fun.
And it was a really great event. And it was just one of those moments where we had inspiration and it came to us. And
How did you use it?
It happened. And it's the same way we use it now. Well, we cut it in smaller portions. But
describe the dish.
It's basically three layers of ganache, one of it being more like a mousse, the middle layer being more with peanuts and actual peanut butter in it, and the last one being with hazelnut chocolate and little kind of crispy cornflake things called feuilletine. And the top is with Newski bacon that gets rendered out till it's almost burnt. It's so crispy because if you let the fat get cold and congeal and then put it on the bacon chocolate bar, it totally takes away from the actual texture.
So it has to be like shatteringly crisp.
Yeah, exactly. It gives it it's part of the whole texture of the dish.
Okay, so let's talk about the pig. You have pig trotter on your menu occasionally. Describe how you do it, John.
Well, the trotter right now, the way we're doing it is we're actually taking it and we're brining it and then we shave the leg.
Describe the shaving of the leg.
It's not very different to like catching a face shave or a leg shave. Like, you basically don't want any hair. We're using Bic razors.
No shaving cream required.
Yeah, you don't want to use shaving cream. Definitely,
there's enough lubrication in the in the pig.
Yes. Totally. So we shave it and then we lay it on a bed of onions and garlic, and we cover it with foil and we cook it low and slow
because
when we pick it up,
around 7 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, because when we actually pick it up is when the skin gets crispy. So it's not like we need to create the skin to be crispy beforehand.
Or any color.
And it took a while to figure out the way we wanted to do it. That's the cool thing about cooking. There's so many different ways that you could get to the finished product.
It's endless learning.
The way we work it is like, you know, John's there usually a lot during the day and I'm usually there a lot at night. And we kind of work on things and techniques and the way we're kind of doing it and knowing that one of us is there at all hours and always keeping a watchful eye on the food is a very comforting thing for both of us, I think.
Has that been sort of one of the best things about moving from catering to a restaurant is being able to have a stable menu where you can really take a dish and do it over and over and over and over and over again?
I think for me, the best thing about the restaurant is like when we had the catering, we got great product. But now that like we have the restaurant and people are recognizing us from the restaurant, it's like the product that we're getting now is like amazing. I mean, you can't even explain the quality of product that we're getting.
So let's talk about pig's trotters, for example. How do you source them?
Our phone lists are huge with different farmers. And, you know, first you find the farmers that provide those products. You know, the other big problem that you have to have is you have to make sure that they're able to provide enough of the product.
Yeah, consistency.
Totally.
I mean, you know that.
There was a while when we were getting like they would send them over to us and it was like just the foot. We didn't want just the foot.
No, you know? That like sort of isn't the point.
It ruins the fun of it. You know what I mean? So, you know, you work hand in hand with people until you find the person that works best for that product.
So you do a lot of farm-to-table sourcing.
I think it's part of our responsibility as chefs, as cooks, that we source things locally and that are of high quality and sustainable. And I think that us, as far as the pigs go and those types of things, it depends on what we're actually going for. You know, if we go to use a whole pig, it might come from a different farm than if we're just using the belly. But they're all sourced from places of good practice. And, you know, that's definitely something we keep in mind first and foremost. But we do not put that on the menu. We don't list all the farm. You know, it's like
and
it
so many vegetarians, like so many vegetarians are always like, man, you guys are like crazy with all this meat. And I'm like, yo, these animals live better lives than us. They're like getting massaged, you know, like come here, you know, and then that's what makes it so tasty. It's the people that we're getting this product from care about it so much that they're taking such high quality care of it before it even comes to us.
God, you guys are great. I'm so glad to have met you. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having us. Really appreciate it.
Vinny DiTolo and John Shook own Animal. It's on Fairfax. There's another restaurant opening across the street serving more pork. It's called The Golden State and features Scoops ice cream, beer from Craftsman Brewery, and hot dogs from Let's Be Frank Dogs. They even serve a beer float, ice cream swimming in beer. Whew. Tainted baby formula in China and peanut butter horror stories are not a new thing. This kind of food fraud has been around as long as money could be made by doing it. The history of food fraud next when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. How much do we really know about the food we eat? Unless we grow it and harvest it ourselves, there has to be some level of trust that what we're getting is what it claims to be. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case. Bea Wilson, the author of the book Swindled, The Dark History of Food Fraud, From Poison Candy to Counterfeit Coffee, is here to open our eyes to the realities of food fraud. Do you think that we're complicit as eaters and drinkers because we're so willing to allow ourselves to be duped?
Sadly, yes. Unfortunately, that is the case. And that goes back a long way, too. I mean, I think it's partly adulteration happens a lot at the bottom of the market because when you're trying to buy food very, very cheaply, there's a big incentive for the seller who's got very low margins just to increase their margins a bit by padding it or diluting it or watering it down in some way. And then they've usually got to disguise the fact they've padded it or diluted it. And I think now what we have is, you know, the cheap foods are the very heavily processed packaged ones. And we have all these legal adulterants, which we call additives. Whereas in the past, yes, I think consumers did sometimes almost collude with the swindlers. I mean, they must have known when they were buying something that was artificially cheap that it wasn't what it seemed. But a bit like when, you know, when a customer is buying a pirated DVD or something, or fake designer perfume, they kind of don't want to think too much about the origins of it, but they don't maybe have the money to buy the real thing.
Share with us some of the older stories of food swindles. Maybe bread. I mean, I think that bread must be just rife with all kinds of swindles.
It is. I mean, and that goes back quite a long way, although in some ways bread would have been better than what we have now in the supermarket, where anything that contains flour and water and probably a whole lot of high fructose corn syrup is allowed to call itself bread, even if it hasn't been kneaded or proved, whereas in the past, governments did set strict rules about bread. Having said which, some pretty nasty things went into bread. I mean, in the 19th century in Britain, everyone wanted to eat white bread because that was the bread of the rich. So even if you were poor, you wanted white bread. And the only way of making bread that seemed like bread out of poor quality white flour was using this additive called alum, which is now used as an emetic to make people vomit. So that gives you a sense of the fact it shouldn't be anywhere near your food.
There was a guy who wrote a treatise on adulterations at the beginning of the 19th century. Share with us the sort of role he had and what people thought of him.
Yeah, so his name was Frederick Achim, and he was a German chemist living in London. And in 1820, he brought out this book which really electrified the British public and the American public too, because it came out in the States at the same time. And he revealed, foodstuff by foodstuff, the fact that almost everything that people were eating at that time wasn't what it seemed. Things like tea leaves, which weren't really tea at all, but just random leaves gathered from the British hedgerows, boiled, baked, dried, and then painted with these toxic colourings. Or these things which he calls factitious peppercorns, which were totally fake peppercorns. So lots of consumers quite wisely avoided buying ground pepper because they knew there was something known in the trade as PD or pepper dust, and that was the disgusting sweepings from the floor of the pepper factory. But you'd think you were safe buying whole peppercorns, but no, because these very ingenious swindlers, as Achim exposed, found a way of manufacturing peppercorns out of linseed oil mixed with clay, mixed with a bit of cayenne pepper to give it that kind of peppery bite, and then just kind of rolled into these tiny balls. It does make you think, what a waste of human intelligence.
That's what I'm thinking. It's so much work, you know.
Absolutely. Very laborious. But there was always a bottom line. It was always worth it. Labor was cheap at that time and spice was expensive. So it's worth their while to do that, sadly.
Wow. So let's talk about some aspects of the current food market that we need to be not so willing complicitors, maybe. Talk about the organic market.
Well, organic is kind of a mixed blessing. I mean, in lots of ways, organic food is something that people put their faith in precisely because they know there are all these scary things happening with large-scale industrial food. And so, as with any other premium food that people will pay a lot of extra money for, that's another big incentive for swindlers. But I think the thing really to worry about is there's also a rise of genuine organic food fraud. And there was this case in London of a very fancy restaurant in Holland Park, which is a fancy bit of town. And a lot of the stars went there. Gwyneth Paltrow was said to be a fan. And it said it sold exclusively organic food. The inspectors then went in and found that over a 50-day period, not a single piece of organic meat had been delivered there, funnily enough. So the so-called organic spice-crusted rack of lamb and organic marinated chicken that these customers were paying a lot of money for was actually just kind of regular industrially produced meat.
So what can we do as eaters and drinkers to be our own best advocates?
Well, first of all, never forget pleasure. I think once we succumb to fear when it comes to food, that's just not a healthy emotion to bring to the dinner table. And just kind of educate yourself about good food. And if you mostly cook food yourself and you know the ingredients that should go into a given dish, then you'll know when you've been served a fake that it doesn't taste right. It's kind of common sense, really, just to rediscover the simple pleasures of good food. I think that's the best protection against swindling that there is.
Thank you, Bea. It's a fascinating book.
Thank you.
Bea Wilson's the author of the book Swindled, The Dark History of Food Fraud, From Poison Candy to Counterfeit Coffee. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for more details on the book. The coast of Southern California isn't only beautiful, it's also really got some great places to eat. I'll be back to take a trip up the coast to eat in Ventura and Santa Barbara. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. I have to admit that for the past 10 years on this show, I've felt guilty about giving our counties to the north short shrift. We frequently talk about the fabulous places to eat and shop here in L.A., but those counties to the north, Ventura and Santa Barbara, have an incredible abundance of choice. Nancy Ransohoff is editor of Hometown Santa Barbara, a new guide to the Central Coast, and she's here to talk about some hot spots. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
Is a lot going on up there with farmers market influenced dining?
There is a lot going on with farmers market. Seasonal produce is really inspiring to almost all the chefs up there, I think. And for a city of its size, Santa Barbara has a lot of terrific dining opportunities from every end of the spectrum, from simple tacos at La Super Rica to, you know, white tablecloth dining at the Hungry Cat or
Oh, that's right. The Hungry Cat is there.
Yeah, we love our cat just as much as you guys do.
Yeah, I bet you do. Okay, so let's start with Santa Barbara.
My new fave is Cafe Luck, which is on East Coda Street, right off the main drag of State Street. It's got a terrific raw bar with oysters, clams, local sea urchins, just all kinds of really fresh seafood, as well as on the menu you'll find the classic hanger steak and frites and a great crispy slow-cooked duck, fresh whole sea bass, and David Rossner does a terrific job. He was at Pastis and Danielle in New York City and Balthazar.
Wow, he made a really big lifestyle change.
Yeah, come into our little town.
Yeah, he must be very happy.
Yeah, we're happy he came because it's a great place. They have a lovely patio for lunch and Sunday brunch. And so that's one terrific new find. And we mentioned the Hungry Cat, and they have some great news there on Chapala, which is also right downtown. They've been bursting at the seams and just bustling and busy ever since they opened. They are moving or expanding into part of Don Q's billiard parlor next door. So we're really excited. They're going to have a second dining room there with their expansion and also start serving lunch, which is great.
For people who don't know about the Hungry Cat, we should say that it's the love child of David Lentz and Suzanne Goen from down here, from Hungry Cat and Luke AOC fame.
And they have all those great farmers market-inspired fresh cocktails and lots of terrific, of course, just fresh off the boat seafood. Let's see, a third one, I'd say one of my faves is Olio e Limone, which is Italian food. It's sort of high-end Italian with a Sicilian emphasis, owned by the Morellos. Lovely little spot on West Victoria Street, also just right off State Street.
So now let's turn our sights to the county immediately north to Los Angeles and south of Santa Barbara, which would be Ventura.
You know, Ventura is becoming quite the hot spot. You might know it as sort of a sleepy little
surf town.
Surf town, but now, you know, it still is that, a sleepy surf town, but now with some great food. Right on Thompson Boulevard is Brooks Restaurant, which is owned by Andy and Jamie Brooks. They opened a couple years ago and revamped the space into a lovely contemporary setting with just terrific food. It's right in the historic downtown district. They have some great marinated boneless short ribs that just melt in your mouth. They're really great. And some homemade spinach ricotta gnocchi with truffled squash and pancetta and just some really creative, good stuff using as much local and organic produce as possible. So that's Brooks on Thompson Boulevard. There's also a terrific new spot called Watermark, and that's right on East Main Street, 598 East Main Street in Ventura, and it's in an old 1920s bank building. Terrific food with everything from great steaks and seafood to a wonderful cioppino, chili-dusted prawns with roasted garlic. You just can't get enough of those. Another thing that we don't think about so much is Ojai as being in Ventura County.
And a lot of people I know have moved from L.A. to Ojai, and a lot of people who have moved seem to be farming.
Yes, they're all of a sudden having these bushels of oranges and avocados and Meyer lemons and sharing the wealth, and we love to share it with them. So through some friends who have done the same thing, we've discovered a new restaurant called Azu, which is right on East Ojai Avenue. And it's sort of a tapas bar, but they also have full-on entrees and homemade gelato. It's just a wonderful place if you're up in Ojai. It's called Azu, A-Z-U. And it's such a wonderful getaway from here. It's so easy to get
to. It's so easy to get to, and it doesn't take long at all.
And yet you feel like you're really far away.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Nancy.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Evan.
Nancy Ransohoff is the editor of Hometown Santa Barbara. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a list of the places Nancy talked about. Comment there, too, if you've got other Oxnard, Ventura, and Santa Barbara places we shouldn't miss. Invasions of territory are not exclusive to humans. Plants and animals can invade each other's cribs, too. I'll be right back with the story of the Asian clam and how it's wreaking havoc in Lake Tahoe. Get a bowl of linguine ready and stay tuned to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Asian clams were first noticed in Lake Tahoe around 2001. Recently, the population has boomed, causing all sorts of problems. Steve Chilton is the Aquatic Nuisance Species Coordinator for the Lake Tahoe and Northern Nevada U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's with us today. Who better to explain the havoc being caused by the Asian clam? So, Steve, tell us about these clams. Why are they such a problem?
Well, Asian clams can have significant impacts on our natural environment. At Lake Tahoe, they concentrate calcium and other elements that could facilitate the establishment of zebra and quagga mussels. Quagga mussels were first discovered west of the Mississippi in Lake Mead in southern Nevada in 2007. They've infested the Great Lakes to an extent where it's costing billions of dollars to control them. They basically destroy water infrastructures.
You mean physically? They wreak physical havoc.
That's right. And they also create major impacts upon basically the food web in a lake or a river, where they filter significant amounts of water, which in doing so they basically consume all of the vegetative and animal matter that juvenile fish generally would eat. They destroy the bottom of the food web, which then as those fish that need to eat from that section, that area, they can no longer survive either. Lake Mead, for example, is seeing a significant reduction in their striped bass population, which is a large game fish.
So basically, the fact that we're starting to see these clams means that Lake Tahoe is near the tipping point of having the quagga mussels come over.
We're at greater risk, is the way we look at it. We're at much greater risk as long as those Asian clams are in the lake. So we have a pilot project that's starting within the next month or so to remove and suffocate, or suffocate and remove, Asian clams in the lake. We're at a point right now with the Asian clam population in Lake Tahoe where it's at a volume or a magnitude that we can still get a handle on it. Where Asian clams are elsewhere in the United States, generally they're so overpopulated at this point that physically there's nothing people can do at that point.
Now, what are characteristics of the Asian clam? Are those the clams that we think of when we think of eating clams, like on top of pasta?
No, not at all. Not at all. These are very small. Basically, a mature Asian clam in Lake Tahoe generally will not exceed an inch in diameter.
So how do you think they got there?
Well, we believe they were probably dropped by anglers, bringing them up possibly from the Sacramento Delta, where they're used as bait. It's possible that live clams are dumped in Lake Tahoe during, for example, a summer fishing trip somewhere between 2000 and 2002. They were dumped in live, and therefore they were able to reproduce. And basically their larva drifts with our literal drift, which in Lake Tahoe basically goes from south to east.
How do you go about collecting them so you can suffocate them?
So what we're going to be doing is, and this is a research project at this point, so basically we'll have divers placing plastic sheets of roughly 20 by 20 foot in diameter on top of the clam beds and anchoring them on all four sides, and that will suffocate them. Basically, they'll be using up the oxygen that's available to them and all the other nutrients that are available to them and suffocating. Then in the second phase, we'll have divers using basically a large vacuum where we'll vacuum these critters up and then put them onto a barge. We're going to ship them down to a composting plant down in the valley, and they'll use it as a soil amendment.
Are Asian clams edible? Can we turn them into a delicacy and eat them into submission?
Well, they are edible. I believe I sent you a recipe for them that one of our researchers had come up with. But it takes an awful lot of them because they are very small. The clams themselves are very small, and the meaty part of the clam is even smaller. So you're looking at something on the order of an eighth of an inch in diameter of edible per clam. So it takes an awful lot. So our joke around here is you get, you know, gather 1,000 clams and have a meal for one.
So when will the pilot project be completed so you'll be able to establish if you'd be able to do it on a larger scale?
Yeah. Well, we'll be leaving these plastic sheets down on the clam beds on a succession of months. For example, some of them will be removing after 30 days, some will be leaving down for 60 days, some for 90 days. So we're looking at a conclusion of this study sometime this summer, when we'll have divers down there assessing just how this worked, what the mortality rate for those clams is, and how we might want to adjust what we're doing to do it better on a larger scale.
Such an interesting story. Thank you, Steve.
Well, you're welcome.
Steve Chilton is the Aquatic Nuisance Species Coordinator for the Lake Tahoe and Northern Nevada U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. See what the pesky Asian clam looks like at kcrw.com/goodfood. Vanilla has been a staple in baking for years. Most of us just grab that imitation stuff in a small brown bottle. It's fake. It's even called imitation. So does it matter? The people at Cook's Illustrated Magazine found out. Stick around and you can find out too. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. question is asked all the time here in L.A., but not usually about vanilla extract. Cook's Illustrated conducted extensive tests to find out if imitation vanilla extract is as good as the pure kind. Jack Bishop is the executive editor of Cook's Illustrated, and he's here to tell us the results. So, Jack, tell us about the taste test. What exactly were you trying to figure out?
Well, we were trying to figure out in real-world applications what you would really do at home. What's the difference? Can you taste the difference between pure vanilla extract, which of course is made from vanilla beans and alcohol, and imitation vanilla extract? And the imitation is either a byproduct of the paper production process or a derivative of coal tar.
Wait. Stop right there. You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. So real vanilla has about 250 different organic compounds that give it its flavor. And the most important of those is something called vanillin, which they can actually manufacture from wood pulp or sawdust or from coal tar. I know, it's very appetizing, but that's the most potent flavor compound, and they can extract those from the manufacturing process when they're making paper. And it's incredibly cheap. And almost all of the commercial uses for vanilla, if you buy, you know, anything flavored with vanilla in the supermarket, it's been probably done with imitation vanilla because it's so much cheaper. And so our question was, you know, when you're baking at home, if you're making a custard or if you are making a cookie or you're making a cake, can you tell the difference? Because the price difference is pretty substantial between the imitation and the pure extract.
What were some of the applications that you thought, well, you know, if you have to use imitation, it's not that bad?
The one where it was the hardest to tell the difference is cookies. And the science here is pretty interesting. The volatile compounds in vanilla extract will cook off at about 280 to 300 degrees. And when you make a cookie, the internal temperature of the cookie gets higher than that. And so basically, the things that you're paying for in pure extract, you end up cooking off. Coupled with the fact that you use so little vanilla in a cookie compared to how much butter and eggs and sugar, that frankly, our tasters had a hard time telling the difference in blind taste tests between cookies that were made, and those were really simple sugar cookies, the difference between ones made with imitation and pure. And even the snobs in the kitchen who said they would never use imitation, frankly, couldn't tell the difference.
So were there certain brands of imitation vanilla that were markedly better than others?
Yes. We had three imitations in the mix, Durkee, McCormick, and Gold Medal. And we really felt like the Gold Medal, besides being the cheapest, was the best. And that the McCormick imitation and the Durkee imitation really were at the bottom of the pack in most of these taste tests. And that the Gold Medal did the best job of having the sort of perfumey vanilla notes. And even in the pudding, which was the hardest of the three tests, where the pure extracts were really much, much better, the Gold Medal wasn't awful. The other two imitations really were pale imitations of the real things when we added them to a pudding.
Okay, so for the custards, the pudding, and the frosting, the things that were more liquidy and didn't really cook into a solid, there it really made a big difference.
Right. And, you know, when we make when we add vanilla extract to a custard, we always add the extract when the custard's done cooking. So it really sees very little heat. You know, you finish taking you take the custard off the heat, you stir in the vanilla, whether you're making a, you know, creme anglaise or a pudding or ice cream base. And so the extract is heated the least. And therefore, the differences between the pure extracts and the imitation were obvious. And in a side-by-side test, I don't think most people, even people who don't work in a test kitchen, would have a hard time telling the difference between the complexity of the pure extract versus the sort of one-note flavors of the imitation extracts in a custard or a pudding.
Okay, so what were the different brands of pure vanilla extract that you tasted? And aside from the differences in geographical provenance, were there marked differences in taste and quality?
Our top-rated pure extract was the McCormick, which is the good news because that's available pretty much in every supermarket in America. What really distinguished the McCormick was a sort of really complex flavor profile. I mean, our tasters were picking up notes of caramel and chocolate and comparing it to Kahlua or Bailey's Irish Cream. And what it didn't have is many of the other pure extracts are very boozy. I mean, by federal law, vanilla extract needs to contain 35% ethyl alcohol. And that boozy flavor can come through, especially in a custard or a pudding. And a lot of our tasters really felt like the booze, the alcohol, was sort of crowding out the vanilla flavors. And for whatever reason, the McCormick just had a sort of stronger vanilla flavor, and the alcohol notes weren't quite as prominent. And people really wanted to taste the vanilla, not the alcohol. And the McCormick Pure Vanilla was our top-rated brand overall.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Evan.
Jack Bishop is the executive editor of Cook's Illustrated. Let me know if you can tell the difference between real and fake vanilla. Comment on the show at kcrw.com/goodfood. There's a lot of hope writing on President Obama, including from those in the food world. How about a website that details Obama food policy and everything food-related in this administration? Great idea, you say? Well, someone's already done it. And I'll talk with him next when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. A listener recently sent me chopsticks from Obama Ramen. Obama Ramen is a restaurant that's in the town named Obama, which is located outside of Kyoto, Japan. Pictured at the very top of the sticks is a picture of President Barack Obama from the back with the ears. It's proof that Obama mania has swept the food world. Blogger Eddie Gaiman Cohan has a blog called Obama Foodorama, where she chronicles everything related to food and Obama. So what's the wackiest Obama food stuff you've encountered?
I think the wackiest is the Obama sushi.
So describe it if you can.
It's a sushi roll that when you cut through the middle of it, it has a picture of Barack in it. The shrimp and rice look like a comical portrait of Barack.
So share another whacked out thing with me, like the sushi.
You know, a lot of the stuff isn't so much whacked as total homage. People adore him. And for foodies, there's so much creating either, you know, his logo, creating beautiful cookies that actually have him silk screened onto it.
I have to say, I went to an event where there were Obama face cookies, mm-hmm. and people didn't know whether they should save them or eat them.
Right.
They felt
right.
that eating them was somehow, I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. How did you fall into this vat of Obama mania seen through food?
Anytime he was criticized, somehow food got in the mix. The arugula elitism charges that came up when he was campaigning in Iowa. He mentioned Whole Foods and arugula. This was a huge kerfuffle. And then there were beer track versus wine track voters. And then Barack didn't want to answer a foreign policy question one day. He was just eating breakfast at a little campaign stop. And he said to the reporter, "Can't I just eat my waffle?" And so all of a sudden, waffles turned into a huge thing. He was waffling on this. He was waffling on that. And then conservatives came up with Barack Obama waffles, an actual package of waffles that they were selling at one of their organizations.
It's like you can't just be.
You can't just be. And then, of course, when you're on the campaign trail, you're always eating. You know, get to know the people by eating their food. And so there are just so many pictures of him taken eating, and people started to track what he was eating.
But, you know, it's really interesting because I don't think I ever remember a picture or a video of Bush passing around cookies. But there's this video on YouTube of Obama passing
exactly.
around oatmeal raisin cookies
right.
at a bipartisan gathering.
Exactly. homemade cookies. He's wooing the Republicans basically with cookies. It's bizarre. I still find it bizarre, even though I've been writing the blog. I find it bizarre how everything somehow gets back to food with him.
I kind of think that's great, though.
I do, too.
You must feature menus, then, from White House events.
Yes, we have the menus. But no one to date at the White House is very good at all at taking actual photos of the food. There's only been one black tie dinner so far and then one midweek. It was called the Charm Offensive Dinner. The press pool is ushered out. And so they're not actually there when the food is served.
So with these menus starting to come out from the White House, mm-hmm. do you notice anything about their style yet when it comes to?
The White House had already, with the Clintons, moved into a very American, local, regional sourcing. They try to highlight the bounty of American food in the White House. And so you can't say that the formal dinners they're serving are, quote unquote, local because you have an entire United States of America.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, the idea is to show off the different
right.
regions. But Walter Scheib, the executive chef for the Bushes and the Clintons, the Bush twos and the Clintons, really transformed the White House into American cuisine. So it seems to have continued onward. And it doesn't, from the menus I've seen, it doesn't seem like there's any kind of transgressive, you know, mania going on. It just seems like really, really excellent cooking at sort of the top of American power with very interesting things.
Have you gotten any information about what they're eating on the family side of the White House?
In their personal kitchen, it's everything. I mean, it's kid food, it's French fries. Michelle Obama has gone on the record as saying she likes trying to introduce vegetables that are as fresh and local as possible into the mix. But grits are a big deal apparently in the morning. And they're just eating like regular people. Most observers on the outside have this assumption that the Obamas are really sophisticated foodies with an amazing palate. But no, they're a family from Chicago or internationally if you're Barack.
Right.
And it's nothing that's really crazy. You know, they have two daughters who eat like most American children, except actually that the school that the girls go to has an amazing lunch program, which is local, organic, sustainable.
Now, I understand that you've applied for a White House press badge. If such a thing comes to pass for you, mm-hmm. what are you hoping that you're going to find midnight munchies at the White House?
But no, there's a really big, you know, there's the private residence kitchen. The private residence is 16 rooms that the Obamas live in.
Right.
And then there's the White House kitchen, which is enormously small. I mean, the regular.
Right.
So, no, I would just want to be the public chronicler of the Obama, the Chowbama history, as I call
I
it. The official historian of Obama food.
Well, I love your site. It's enormously entertaining. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Blogger Eddie Gaiman-Cohan writes the blog Obama Foodorama. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to read more. Be my Facebook fan. Add me, Evan Kleiman, to your profile. Also, did you know that you can embed the show on your blog or webpage? Just go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. You can read the Good Food blog there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moore, and Steve Billings. Gary Masiha is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.